Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. The Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. And welcome to our People in the News episode where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today we are talking with Mrs. Holly Lamar. Mary Holly Holiday Lamar, born in Atlanta, Georgia, is an American country music singer-songwriter. Lamar co-wrote Breathe, you just heard that, a number one country and adult contemporary single by Faith Hill. Her songs have also been recorded by Sarah Evans, Wynonna Judd, Lone Star, Tim McGraw, Joe DiMassina, and Jessica Simpson, among others. In 2002, Lamar was one of the first artists signed to Universal South. Between 2002 and 2003, she had two singles on the Billboard Hot Country Singles and Tracks chart. The first, These Are the Days, was previously recorded by Joe DiMassina on her 2000 album, Burn. Deborah Evans Price of Billboard called it a solid song and a great performance that adds up to a promising debut from a new voice with a lot to say. Well, let's find out about that. Hello, Ms. Lamar. How are you today?
Hi. Yes, I'm doing fine on this beautiful spring day.
It is a beautiful day in Tennessee. I love it when that happens. Did you get to know Faith Hill when she recorded your song, Breathe?
Yeah, to a degree. You know, at the time when I pitched the song to, it was initially put on hold by Tim McGraw's producer, Byron Gallimore, by his wife, Missy Gallimore, for Tim McGraw. When she first heard it, actually, Faith wasn't even cutting at the time. And obviously, Faith and Tim were already married and together. Initially it was put on hold for Tim, but he thought very wisely, I think, that it would be, although, you know, who I would have loved to see Tim in satin sheets, but
the video,
but, yeah. But I think he thought it would be better for her. So, it worked out pretty well. She cut the song, and then, over the next year or two, Tim cut one of my songs. So I did, you know, see them at the part, you know, the number one parties, and get to know them through Byron and Missy. And they're super, super nice people.
Just are they nice people?
Down,
yeah.
Down to earth, very down to earth, kind, nice, appreciative people.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting thing going on here. Beechwood Hall, I keep forgetting. And they used to own that property, and it was sold here in Leaper's Fork. And now there's a big to-do. Kid Rock's involved trying to stop any development of that property. You probably don't know anything about that, but it seems like they're getting a bad rap. She's very popular now, of course, for her role on 1883, the Yellowstone prequel with Tim McGraw. And people may remember you from your appearance on the BBC daytime TV show Homes Under the Hammer, 1.5 million viewers per episode. Did you enjoy working on TV?
I did. I enjoyed it. I really loved doing property development. I sold my music catalog in 2010 and moved to England just to do something different. And I made an album while I was there. Which has not yet been released. There is a single off of that album called Eagle, actually, that's on Apple Music. But I made that with some legendary musicians, Pino Palladino and Robbie McIntosh. Hopefully I'll bring that album out in the next year or so. But love doing property development, bought a house at auction. You know, they happened to be there filming the auction. And when they found out, you know, that I was a songwriter and all had written Breathe, they asked if they could film the whole process. And it was great. I loved it. I can remember being in Scotland and somebody says, "Oh, you're the girl from Homes Under the Hammer," you know. So it was pretty cool. Yeah.
I found when I was doing some homework on you, I found that you said you inherited your love of renovation, refurbishing, and creating magic from your mother, Mary Lee Lamar, at a young age. You have a good relationship with your mom?
I did. Sadly, she passed away. May of 2020, from a combination of Parkinson's and something called pseudo supranuclear palsy, which is similar to Lou Gehrig's disease. So that was, I came back from Europe basically to take care of her. And then, when she passed away, I decided to come back to Nashville to, you know, dip my feet back in the water of the music songwriting business here, and then ended up, of course, setting up a falconry.
We'll get into that in a second. So while you were still in the UK, you bought a house at auction in the Fulham area of London. Do you like Tennessee better than London?
You know, it's so different. I love London. I mean, it is probably, I mean, other than Paris, to me, Paris is the greatest city in the world. But London is up there, top five, you know. Okay. It's just such a melting pot. And the British are just so fascinating. And of course, we get so much of our history from the British, even though we don't want to say that. You know, because there's this still how many hundreds of years later, there's this huge rivalry. And they actually take it more seriously than we do still. You know, we're still the colonials, you know.
That's because we won and they.
Yeah, I know. They're still upset. Still upset, you know. But it's two countries divided by the same language, supposedly, but they have a totally different language, which I love. I love all the epithets and strange, you know, bloody hell and, you know, those kinds of things. But yeah, London is great. Tennessee is beautiful. The weather in Tennessee, I think, is better. So, you know, there's that London gray, and I'm originally from Florida, Georgia. So, okay. I like the heat and the sunshine. So in that sense, I definitely prefer Tennessee, but I think there's a lot of history in London and in England that, you know, it's fascinating. It's ancient.
Yes, that's for sure. Billboard wrote about your song Unkissed as one of Nashville's most successful songwriters. Holly Lamar is looking to make the transition to recording artist with a forthcoming album on Universal South. If this debut single is any indication of what's to come, Lamar won't be standing in the wings much longer. Her voice is compelling, but it is also has a sweet, vulnerable tone that's particularly effective on this well-written ballad about a woman who is so smitten that she feels incomplete without the guy. Do you have fond memories of making that song?
Yeah, I do. I wrote that song with a guy named Barry Alfonso, and I can remember, you know, being in Sylvan Park, living in the rental house that I was in at the time and writing it. And it's just a sweet kind of innocent song. You know, unfortunately, things behind the scenes, you know, weren't set up for my launch, really, as far as an artist is concerned. And so my entire record never really made it out. You know, the two singles did pretty well, and I actually co-produced that album with Byron Gallimore. I originally was signed to MCA through Tony Brown, but he left MCA to set up Universal South whilst I was making my record, which I co-produced, and I was really proud of particularly those two singles. But at the time, being such a new label, they didn't have all the marketing and everything set up. And, you know, also I have to say, you know, Breathe kind of created a little bit of a backlash in the country music market where they didn't, you know, even Faith herself on her next record went a little bit more country than the Breathe album to kind of cater to, you know, her base. And my album sort of was even almost went a little bit more pop than, even though it definitely had some country undertones, and that song in particular, Unkissed, was pretty organic and country. But it
And these are
certainly
the this is the pre Taylor Swift, pre Miley Cyrus days. I don't know if that even counts, but you were ahead of your time, so to speak. You brought a
Yeah, a
little
little bit ahead of my
pop.
time, and sometimes I think that album would be more releasable now, you know. And I mean, to be truthful, I was always more of an Americana kind of an artist than anything, and that's what the album I did in England is more singer-songwriter Americana. It's not really country, although there's one song that could, I think, be a country hit. But yeah, I loved making that song and making that record. I just it wasn't the right timing, you know. And then I had other things. I just decided that I was at an age where if I didn't leave Nashville and go out into the world and explore and even write other types of music, that I would never do it. So I left.
And it's a terrible story. I mean, around the same time you ended up on you obviously talk about this. It's out there in the public eye. You ended up on the brink of bankruptcy. Another songwriter promised you 30% gains in something called Global Mass Limited, but instead of profits, you lost over $500,000. And he only went to a Singapore jail for 1 year. Why so short of jail time?
Well, unfortunately, because sadly, most of that money ended up in th going through Malaysia rather than Singapore. Only $40,000 of that money went through Singapore. I probably spent about 20 grand just going to Singapore to file the police report and get them involved. It was a complete, you know, kind of a Bernie Madoff thing. A guy named David Plait, who's a sadly a member of the Mormon Church, and he it was several members of the Mormon Church who were all involved, including Todd Peterson, who was a is still an attorney in Connecticut, and they were never punished here in the United States, which they should have been because they were in the United States when they committed the crimes. He admitted, you know, conning me of the entire amount. But again, the 40,000, they were only able to get him on money laundering, not fraud, because that amount is what went through Singapore. So Malaysia never investigated it. England investigated it, but handed it over to Singapore. And then the United States, I could never get the FBI involved, even though we know that most of the money made its way back into the United States, but it went through Asia. And unfortunately, it's just all too easy. I mean, it's stunning. I was stunned. I never thought $500,000 could just disappear and nobody would care. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, and the headline says American con man David John Plait's case was first time foreign scammer is found guilty of money laundering in Singapore. That's history you don't want to be part of.
And it's crazy because I'm sure there is so much scam going through Singapore. That's the reason he registered the business there, because it gives legitimacy to a business, but at the same time, the you can just get any person there to be a director. It has to be a local Singaporean who's the director of the company, and he just I think they just paid somebody to do it, and that gave them legitimacy, and they were able to con a lot of people. There were a lot of people conned besides myself, and he's been doing this for 20 years and continues to do so. I get calls from people who've been conned by him since.
Was
And
this a
it's
movie or a music industry related scam? Because he was a
no, not at
songwriter. You were
all.
no, just friends of friends of
Nothing to do
friends.
with music at all. I knew the guy from my investment banking days when I was an investment banker on Wall Street in New York City right out of college. So
Okay.
nothing to do with music.
All right. Good. Well, I guess that's not
That's
good.
one
Terrible.
good
But you
story.
survived it, made you stronger.
Oh, well, yeah, it has made me stronger, yes.
So in October of 2018, there was an issue in England that you had to plead guilty to two offenses relating to the illegal possession of a wild and unregistered peregrine falcon. and received an 18-week sentence for each, suspended for 12 months, as well as being sentenced to 120 hours of community service. What's the deal with that?
Well, that's one of those situations, kind of like what recently happened, where, you know, sometimes when you're a person that has done things in your life and succeeded, law enforcement likes to try and target you. And I actually had reported people that were stealing peregrines from the wild for the 2 years prior to that. So in 2016, I made a police report that somebody that I had had some business dealings with in the falconry world, the breeding world in England, I made a report against him when I found out what he was doing, and tried, you know, essentially made the decision to distance myself from him. And at that point, the wildlife police came to me to try, I guess, to try to get information. I really didn't have anything. I had just knew that he was bad news. But I spent the next 2 years digging and reporting things that were information that was given to me by other people who wanted this guy stopped. And so I have 2 years of documentation and evidence of me reporting crimes to these wildlife officers, the very same officers, and they never did one thing about it. So I got very fed up. I became targeted by this guy who then decided to launch a social media campaign against me, accuse me of the very thing he was guilty of, claim all kinds of things that I had done with my birds, which wasn't true, like abuse, all kinds of things. And because he was a man and in a man's world to an extent, and because he was British and I was American, and I think there was a degree of jealousy from people in the falconry world that when I got into it, you know, I was well known, I had money, I was able to purchase expensive birds. So there was some resentment and jealousy there. You know, again, I was American. You know, they still have all that resentment against us for winning the war. And what happened was I gave up on the police, and I happened to, you know, I believe I was set up, basically. I know I was set up because I have texts to prove it, that somebody basically dropped off a baby, like defenseless peregrine falcon with me. I just did what I would do with anything, you know. I'd done a lot of raising money for wildlife rehab, and I just raised the falcon quietly. I would have contacted police had I thought they would do anything, but having contacted them 8 times prior, I just decided I would make sure it lived and fly it and release it to the wild myself without any, just do the best I could, you know? They somehow, spying on me, I guess, found out or set it up, and they got the very same wildlife police to come and raid. And I have no idea where that falcon came from. And that's essentially the law there is very archaic.
A Wildlife and Countryside Act warrant was executed at your home, was raided by the Derbyshire Police and the UK Wildlife Crime Unit.
It was pretty harrowing. Yeah. And they,
guns drawn and everything.
Sadly, I have no idea. All I would have had to do was register as keepers. Just say I found the bird in the wild and register as keeper because I was a falconer. All I had to do was fill out a piece of paper. But I didn't know that because I didn't lived in England my whole life, you know. I just was, you know, I gave up on the police. So I was just trying to make the bird live. And I had a rehab certification. So I was doing what I knew to do. And they came and raided. And unfortunately, there's a law there. It's strict liability. It's like, for example, I try to explain it to people. If you know somebody who's doing drugs, and you care about them, and you can't, you know they got some and they've hidden it, say your child, they've hidden it under the bed, you take it away from them so they won't do it. They get angry with you and call the police on you, and the police find it on you. That's it. It doesn't matter. Like, unless you can, I mean, there's no defense. So that law, basically, they've used it to convict mentally retarded people who found like an egg collection at a garage sale. And they don't know that the egg is some peregrine falcon egg or something like that. I mean, basically the wildlife police can't catch anybody there. So they end up getting people who are like myself, just innocently trying to save a bird, or someone who's mentally not able to know that what they've done is against the law, and they're just caught with this and they can't prove where they got it from. And that's strict liability. You can't defend it. It's automatic.
It's really weird. And I was reading the court documents. The Chesterfield Magistrates Court heard the bird was wearing a tag from a captive bred peregrine whose remains were found in a freezer without a leg. Why was it in the freezer, and how did they even hear about it?
Well, they raided the property. So I think this, again, I was set up. Sadly, that was one of my falcons that had passed away, not even at my house. It was being kept by a friend at the time. And most falconers, if a bird dies, they will keep it for taxidermy purposes. This was on the heels of having had this $600,000 stolen. So I was going through a really, really tough time. And the guy that I had reported to the police on was a serious gangster. And I lived half a mile away from him. So I was not in a good place. I was in fear for my life, to be frank.
Yeah.
And I was in fear for the lives of my birds, because he could easily come on my property. But I also was trying to protect this baby peregrine. I just thought I was doing the right thing. So I simply took the ring off the bird that had already passed away and put it on this baby, so that when they were spying on me, because I knew they were spying on me, they would drive by my house and there was a way that they could see into my backyard. And I had seen this on social media. I know this guy had stolen birds from other people. So I was afraid that he would see a bird without a ring and steal it and take it and sell it into a breeding thing. So I just made sure that it had a ring on it temporarily until I could release it back to the wild. You know, it wasn't the brightest decision I ever made. You know, in hindsight, I wish I'd have just never taken the bird in. But I'm one of those people that just, like, I see a little defenseless, starving creature that is gonna die or be abused, and I did the thing that I thought I could wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and feel okay about myself.
Falcons are amazing birds. I would hate to see them sitting on the side of the road suffering.
Yeah, it's not the only way I can try and make people understand, and it's not the same equivalence, but it's kind of like if you were living in France when the Germans were persecuting the Jews and hiding a Jewish person, you know, you'd be shot for that, and it would be wrong, but you think you're doing the right thing. So I thought I was protecting the bird from this person who was persecuting me. I mean, and I have all these emails. I made police reports against him in fear of my life. I said that he threatened my life, but they don't care. The police just didn't care. So
You were banned from owning or being in possession of any birds classed as Schedule 4, I want to know what that is, of the Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981, which are birds that must be registered and ringed if kept in captivity. So you couldn't own birds anymore.
Peregrine falcons and golden eagles, that was it.
Okay, which was what your primary birds were.
My license wasn't revoked. I just wasn't able to be. Now, here's the funny thing. Other people who had similar any violations, and you know, these wildlife officers in the past, it was proven that they literally set people up on purpose. I know other breeders and other falconers that they literally this was a big news story, say 8 years prior, where they literally conspired to put birds on somebody's property just to get them. So it's funny because it sounds really bad, but all anybody ever does in that situation is they just sign the birds over to their wife or their husband or their daughter or son living in the same house, and they can keep the birds. Yeah.
Okay. It's, nice loophole there.
Yeah.
All right. So that was the UK law. We love America, home of the free and brave. Can't happen here, right? So we'll segue to that. Tell us about Wing Blade Falconry in Nashville. When did you get involved in these birds here?
Well, I had to come back to the United States to take care of my mother, who was passing away. So I returned. And when she passed away, I had always planned to continue falconry. It's a love of mine. It's a passion. It's a spiritual practice for me. And I've always been involved in conservation. You know, like I said, I raised money for this bald eagle that had passed away, was killed by a plane back in, I think, around 2011. And that was the song Eagle that I wrote. Anyway, and I got involved in rehabilitation. I got my basic certification. So I always wanted to go back to falconry. And when I returned to Tennessee to go back into the music business, I basically, full disclosure, told them what happened in England and gave them all the evidence from it. And the guy at the time agreed that, you know, I'd probably been set up by some dirty wildlife officers and a dirty falconer. And so they gave me my license, and I got subsequently federal permits for what's called a falconry school. And that was, you know, I had started doing that in England, and I was doing that until I left. You know, with my history as a performer, I love talking to people and I love presenting things and I love educating people. But more than anything, I believe that giving somebody the experience of being up close and personal with birds of prey, you know, being able to actually handle them as you can in falconry and see them flown, as they've been for 7,000 years, falconry dates back to about 5,000 BC, really is the best way to do two things, which is number one, give them an insight into their own soul as a human being and how that soul is really actually connected to every other living thing, whether it be a tree, you know, the wind, a bird of prey, other birds, the quarry that you hunt with birds of prey, but also gives them an insight into the birds. And so they leave an experience like that caring more about these birds because they've been that close to it. So without a personal experience, you just don't care about things, you know, it's like, so it's kind of like flying to the moon might make you care more about the moon, you know?
So unless something's changed, you have Abe, who's an auger buzzard, Sophia, a saker falcon, Grisabella, eagle owl, Houdini, aplomado falcon, dart, American kestrel, Maggie, aplomado, Faith, a peregrine falcon, Levi, a peregrine, Georgia, Harris's hawk, Rico, a saker, Bernie, a plumado, and Bubba, a barn owl. Any additions or subtractions since
that
was posted?
Yeah, sadly, the peregrine falcon Faith died in the city of TWRA. That's the falcon that died.
Oh, okay, we'll talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Bubba, the barn owl, has since passed away from severe anemia. So I've had severe fallout from what happened. Rico, the saker falcon, was pretty much all of his feathers were destroyed in the custody of TWRA, which caused him to break his wing.
Oh gosh.
So we've had some serious fallout, but all the other birds are alive and well, and they're all traumatized by what happened, however.
So here's what you wrote about it. Wing blade falconry is the evolution of my search for the deepest connection between myself, soul, and the rest of the world. I spent years chasing people, places, and things outside myself, thinking I would somehow feel whole and therefore happy when I obtained them. I went from investment banking to my greatest worldly success in music as a songwriter, singer, producer, to spiritual practices, to property development. And now, over the last 4 years, birds, particularly birds of prey. Sound right?
Yeah, I probably wrote that a few years ago. So I've now been practicing falconry for 11, 12 years. Okay. So, yeah. I mean, I still, you know, am involved in music. I'm doing some teaching. I've got an album that I want to release. But I, you know, there's only about four places or five places in the whole United States who have this falconry school license. And so when I set that up, it just took off. I mean, because I would have people driving from Chicago, from Indianapolis, from all sorts of places to come and have an experience, an up close experience with a bird of prey. And so it just took off, and I didn't really go back into the music business as much as I had anticipated that I would. And it just gives me so much satisfaction, and happiness. You know, I'm, you know, it's as much, it's living in the present moment in a way that you can't, I think, do almost doing anything else. And when you're in the present moment, you're not in the future or the past, and you're just appreciating what you have right now. And that's where God is.
That's right. And here's a review I wanted to read. My son and I recently had the pleasure of spending an afternoon with Holly and her birds. It was an unforgettable, exceptional knowledge of the birds. She does a fantastic job in explaining the different types of raptors and the art of falconry. The birds are magnificent, and it was so cool to interact with them. It is a unique experience, truly once in a lifetime experience. We hope to make another visit in the future. Jeffrey S. Thanks, Jeffrey S. What are the different types of raptors and the art of falconry he's talking about?
Well, falconry dates back to at least around 5,000 BC. I'm still a vegetarian, so I never had any desire to hunt. I only hunt, you know, with my birds for their food and food for my other birds. But I have grown, sadly, from a person who I couldn't even look at a day old chick, much less gut one or gut a rat or a quail or anything like that. God has a sense of humor. It's like the thing that you most judge or avoid becomes the thing that, you know, sometimes slap, you know, he or it allows to slap you in the face with, so that you get over that judgment, you know. And that's what happened with me with falconry. They're just such incredible beings that have sense powers that really are supernatural. You know, the eagle is the fourth strongest creature in the world in terms of its own body weight and what it's able to carry. They can carry four times their own body weight. Wow. The peregrine falcon is, of course, the fastest creature on the planet, can travel at 250 miles an hour. Wow. So they have eyesight that is 8 to 10 times better than ours. They could read a book from a quarter mile away if they could read. They have strength. I mean, a golden eagle has a PSI in her talons of up to like 600 pounds per square inch, which is the same as the jaws of life, that, you know, that hydraulic machine that we use to take people out of cars. So for the weight that they are, a female golden eagle weighs, you know, 13 pounds. She has a 600 pound PSI. So they are extraordinary creatures. To me, it just proves there is no such thing as chaos behind creation.
Wow. Yeah.
And getting to interact with these birds, you've got three different orders, essentially. You've got falconiforms, which is your falcons. You've got excipitriforms, which is your eagles, hawks, buzzards, vultures, harriers, kites. And then you've got your strigiforms, which is owls. So those are the three main orders that as a falconer, you might hunt with birds from each of those orders. And essentially, the reason people in the United States don't know about falconry or understand it, and it's not a cultural heritage here like it is in England and France and Germany and Europe and Asia, because by the
Middle
time,
East.
Yeah, by the time North America was colonized, of course, we had guns. So it wasn't as much a part of everyday life as it was prior to that. You know, prior to the advent of guns, everybody in a village in England would have had a bird of prey. So your ancestors, I don't know where what your ancestry is. I'm English, Scottish, and French. My ancestors were falconers. Most people's ancestors were falconers. Shakespeare was a falconer. Henry VIII was a falconer. Elizabeth I was a falconer.
I don't know where mine come from, but I love that movie Lady Hawk. So I know that they were a big deal.
A priest was a falcon.
Yeah. So Wingblade Falconry is in Davidson County. That's where Nashville is.
Yes, it's North Nashville. Mm-hmm.
They leveled 30 misdemeanors against you. You said, they said, we are pleased. Well, your lawyer said, we are pleased that Holly has finally been vindicated and agreed with Judge Jones that Holly's constitutional rights were violated. It is unfortunate that Holly and her birds were put through this ordeal. We are exploring all available remedies to compensate Holly for what she has lost and to ensure nothing like this happens again, said Ben Rabin, who is your attorney. Why don't you tell us about that now? That's the big to-do.
Well, I'll tell you honestly, and I hate to say this because I feel that it probably will give some gratification to the wildlife officer who's mainly responsible for all of that. He was ignorant of Tennessee wildlife law. Those above him allowed his ignorance to continue and be put into practice with the actions that were taken. I had for several months prior, been in contact with this guy who took over from the previous guy who'd given me my falconry license. And he just decided, well, basically he told other falconers, he made a statement that when I took this job, I knew I was going to have to shoot a hostage. And you guys are just lucky that Holly stepped into my crosshairs.
Nice.
Now, so that's me having contacted him numerous times to make sure that I was complying with all of the laws and letting him know that I had gotten these various federal permits, which were more than any other. I currently believe that I have more permits from the federal government and the state government than any other falconer in the state. I have at least 3 federal permits and my state falconry license. And, you know, given what happened to me in England, I bent over backwards to make sure that I was complying. And I had numerous emails to him stating that. But he simply had no understanding of wildlife law. He didn't understand the federal permits. And he basically decided alone that the fact that Tennessee's falconry laws say that you can only have 5 raptors on your falconry permit means that you can only have 5 raptors, period, across all permits. Meanwhile, I have 3 federal permits that allow for unlimited numbers of raptors. It is impossible to carry out breeding of raptors, which I have a permit for, falconry school, which I have a permit for, and bird abatement, which is a conservation way of carrying out organic pest control, with only 5, plus falconry with only 5 birds. It's impossible. It would be cruel to the birds. He wouldn't listen to anybody. I'm a member of the American Falconry Conservancy, which is a nationwide falconry group that's involved in a lot of activity and lobbying for falconry and falconry regulation. The president of that organization even called him and spoke to him and tried to explain to him where he was wrong. He refused to acknowledge that. And basically, withheld information and lied to get a DA and judge to sign the warrant that he got. The claims were wrong. The judge said that the laws were ambiguous and vague. They'd been interpreted one way for 20 years, and he just decided to interpret them a different way. I made multiple complaints about him to his, there was an incoming new executive director, Jason Maxedon. 5 days before the search warrant was executed, I sent probably 10 emails to him. I was on the phone with Colonel Darren Ryder, who was the head of law enforcement for TWRA. I basically said to them, I also contacted the Wildlife Commission and sent them a letter and said that I thought this guy was misinterpreting the laws and that they needed clarifying and we needed better laws. And
so Holly, I only have a few minutes left with you, but yeah. The judge said that you have a case for malicious prosecution. Are you going to go after the TWRA? And one of your birds died, you did tell us. So it sounds like they have a illegal seizure, which is your Fourth Amendment violation of your rights. And I guess ultimately, who was worse, the con man in Singapore, UK's 120 hours of community service, or the legal process, which is the punishment in Tennessee to be vindicated of your constitutional rights?
I don't know. I have to say that having my birds seized the way they were here in Tennessee is probably the worst thing I've ever gone through. Losing my money was, at the time, the worst thing I'd ever gone through. And it almost killed me. But, you know, I kind of got through that. And I had I not gone through that, had I not gotten the strength from that, I wouldn't have made it through this. I can tell you that there were some days where I felt suicidal. Tennessee. It was, they took my children, you know, and it just was so wrong, so clearly wrong. And I was so clearly targeted because of who I was in Tennessee as a songwriter, but also what had happened in the UK. They just thought, oh, she'll be easy to get, you know? And
so the Tennessee Wildlife and Resource Agency is worse than the Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981.
Oh God, yeah, what they did was worse. Yeah, they put numerous, I mean, the birds in nothing in the UK ever got seized. They took these birds and were keeping birds in dog kennels.
Oh my gosh.
For 5 months. You wouldn't keep your dog in a dog kennel for 5 months, would you? It was a rehabber. Middle Tennessee Raptor Center kept three of my birds in dog kennels for 5 months. And this wildlife officer sat on the stand and said that this was a state-approved facility. That's against the law for a rehab center. That's against the law for them to keep birds like that unless they're injured. My birds were not injured. They were healthy, you know, in a dog kennel. No natural sunlight, no bath. Meanwhile, they charged me for not having two baths the day they executed the search warrant. Well, we were cleaning the baths. We were pressure washing that day. It's disgusting. They ruined birds' lives.
Were there any consequences for that guy post the judge's rulings, or does he just go
not
about
yet.
Harassing other people? Not yet. It's
not
ongoing.
Yet.
Okay,
not
well,
yet.
Holly, thank you for your time. I wish we could go on for a lot longer, but I do appreciate you. We are at the end here, so tell everyone how they can come and experience your birds, follow you on social media, find your music, anything you want to tell us.
Yeah.
Tell us how we can find you.
Well, my website is wingbladefalconry.com. So please come and book an experience to come out and do our 2.5-hour immersive meet, greet, and fly experience. We also have a GoFundMe. If you go on to GoFundMe, what's the number that is? If you just look up Wingblade Falconry on GoFundMe.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, we're about $25,000 in debt from legal fees.
Wow.
Due to the seizure. And so we appreciate any donations there. We managed to raise about $8,000, but it doesn't even come close to covering the legal fees. So come visit us even more so. On Instagram, again, it's Wingblade Falconry, WingBladeFalconry. and our Facebook page, Wingblade Falconry. And then if you want to find out about me as a musician, songwriter, singer, that's pretty easy. It's hollylamar.com, HollyLamar.com. And I do have the song Eagle, which is out on, you can buy it on the iTunes music store.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we'll put all that in the show notes. And thanks again for coming on with us.
You're welcome. And just to answer your question, we do plan some consequences for TWRA. I just can't speak about it yet, but you'll find out soon enough.
Oh, good. Justice is coming. Thanks again.
Well, that depends on the justice system.
My name is Tom Anko. I'm a freelance writer and a staunch conservative, and you're listening to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast.
I don't understand.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, we heard a lot. What did you think of our guest, Ms. Holly Lamar, and her birds?
Well, at first we started out with her music and all that, and I was kind of interested. And then as the topic went on, I mean, Steve, what a woman. She's been through such traumatic experiences 3 times. And the third one being the worst, being here in the United States.
Isn't that the kicker right there, kicking the nads?
Wow. So what a strong woman. And now she's out there helping other people, utilizing her her love for and passion for falconry, and helping other people to come out there and realize that they too can have that strength just by being a part of God's nature. That birds are like cats to me. They are, my cat goes out and just takes care of business, and birds do the same thing. They take care of business.
Not a cat guy myself, but I do look forward to going out and doing that immersion in her birds. That sounds really fun in North Nashville. So thank you, Holly, for coming on. Okay, first things first, as promised, as always, we got a comment for me to read. This one left on Podomatic, and it's about last week's episode number 79, the Let's Go Brandon trademark one. Brandon has his fingers on the pulse of what is going on in Tennessee. Same with Steve. Thank you. And his questions that get to the heart of the matter. Dixiecrats are transpublicans. They could not get elected without identifying as a Republican. So they identify as one thing, but operate as another. That was from Larry Linton. I hope that name is familiar. He was my guest on episode 48, Liberty Leadership and Lies.com. There you go, Brandon. I got you a listener. Thank you, Larry. Okay, very urgent. The FDA is raising the white flag on the mRNA COVID shots. Unvaccinated adults will no longer be offered more than a single mRNA dose. Tell that to the 230 million Americans who already took one and two. And almost no one under 65 is eligible for a second booster anymore. The Food and Drug Administration just all but gave up on mRNA COVID jabs. This afternoon, under the guise of simplifying the COVID vaccination schedule, the FDA ended the two-dose mRNA vaccine regimen for unvaccinated people. Doesn't matter to me, it never was going to do it. Americans have not yet been vaccinated can now receive only a single dose of the newer bivalent vaccines, which supposedly work better against the Omicron strain, which is gone, though real-world evidence of their improved effectiveness
efficacy.
Is nearly non-existent. Here we are again, producer Steve, trying to save the world one podcast episode at a time. We're at episode 81.
I know.
That was my high school football number, so it's a special one to me. And no, I wasn't very good, even though I was a wide receiver, so don't ask. But I'm not as bad a salesperson as those at Budweiser, Ambev, Belgian owned now. Do you know who Dylan Mulvaney is?
No, I have no idea who this person is at all.
All right. Well, she's all the rage in the news. He is. So let's listen to clip number one.
Hi. Impressive carrying skills, right? I got some Bud Lights for us. So I kept hearing about this thing called March Madness, And I thought we were all just having a hectic month, but it turns out it has something to do with sports. And I'm not sure exactly which sport, but either way, it's a cause to celebrate. This month, I celebrated my day 365 of womanhood, and Bud Light sent me possibly the best gift ever, a can with my face on it. Check out my Instagram story to see how you can enjoy March Madness with Bud Light and maybe win some money, too. Love ya! Cheers! Go team!
You know, did you ever see that Exorcist movie, Steve?
Of course, Linda Blair,
Linda Blair spews that vomit out.
And her head turns around.
That's what I do when I look at this person.
Well, that is Anheuser-Busch's insult to women, in my opinion, by using a man who thinks he's a woman to sell Budweiser to men who mostly drink Budweiser. That's why I'm wearing my Yingling shirt on. That's a Pennsylvania brewery, oldest in the country. Not so bad of a beer. I'm getting used to it. I used to be a huge Bud drinker, but no more. And I want to read this to you. Inside the CEI system, pushing brands to endorse celebs like Dylan Mulvaney, who you just heard, by Dana Kennedy at New York Post. Executives at companies like Nike, Anheuser-Busch, and Kate Spade, whose brand endorsements have turned controversial trans influencer Dylan Mulvaney into today's woke it girl, aren't just virtue signaling. They're handing out lucrative deals to what were once considered fringe celebrities because they have to, or risk failing an all-important social credit score that could make or break their businesses. At stake is their Corporate Equity Index, or CEI score, which is overseen by the Human Rights Campaign, the largest LGBTQ+ political lobby group in the world. HRC, which has received millions from George Soros' Open Society Foundation, there's always a George Soros angle, among others, issues report cards for America's biggest corporations via the CEI, awarding or subtracting points for how well companies adhere to what HRC calls its rating criteria. Businesses that attain the maximum 100 total points earn the coveted title Best Place to Work for LGBTQ equality. 15 of the top 20 Fortune-ranked companies received 100% ratings last year, according to HRC data. More than 840 U.S. companies racked up high CEI scores, according to the latest report. The HRC, which was formed in 1980 and started the CEI in 2002, is led by Kelly Robinson, who was named as president in 2022 and worked as a political organizer for Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. The HRC lists five major rating criteria, each with its own lengthy subset for companies to gain or lose CEI points. Clip number two, please.
Now to a story which has infuriated feminists. Biological man Dylan Mulvaney, who identifies as a woman, and is now being used by sporting giant Nike to promote women's clothing.
You can describe what you see, Steve.
The person's
dancing. Now, in response, the Daily Mail ran a piece from American writer Maureen Callahan, who condemned the company. So Nike pays a trans woman who parodies my gender to wear their sports bra, but was once accused of cutting salaries of its pregnant ambassadors. Enough, ladies. Let the pushback begin. Now, let's bring the panel back in to discuss. Kosha, let's go to you for reaction to this. What do you make of this saga, and do you think that this PR tactic by Nike will backfire?
It's an interesting one. So, you know, Dylan Mulvaney is enjoying 15 minutes of fame. It might be longer right now, where he was out of a two-bit actor and, you know, is now getting, like, these massive, massive endorsement deals. So with Nike, maybe with the base, it fits more. He was also the brand ambassador for Budweiser, where there's been a big uproar where that brand and the people who consume that product don't really align with what Dylan Mulvaney stands for. So it's sort of all over the place. Mm. Will it backfire? I'm not sure. I think ultimately, Jack, it's sort of there's a calculation going on in these corporations that there is some undefined benefit from aligning with these causes that supersedes what it might do in terms of brand erosion or not serving certain segments of the consumer base. And that's just a calculation they're making.
I agree. Sophie, final thoughts.
Why did they do this, Jack? I mean, what's the real reason behind this? It's provocative. And why didn't they find a biological female to front that ad? They're going to get a reaction. They already have got a reaction. But I'm not so sure this is a clever move by Nike to do this.
Honey. Woke ratings. Advocacy group Human Rights Campaign introduces the 100-point corporate equality index to score companies on their inclusiveness. Number one, workforce protections. 5 points possible. No discrimination for employment for sexual orientation or gender identity. Two, inclusive benefits. 50 points possible. Criteria here includes providing healthcare for same-sex couples. Three, supporting an inclusive culture, 25 points possible, including gender-neutral dress codes and trans-inclusive restrooms facilities policies. Number four, corporate social responsibility, 20 points possible, marketing or advertising to LGBTQ consumers, which would include Nike and Bud Light's use of transgender spokesman Dylan Mulvaney. Number five, responsible citizenship, minus 25 points. Points deducted if a company gives money to organizations whose primary mission includes advocacy against LGBTQ equality, which is not defined, but could include Christian groups. Sounds like discrimination to me. The main categories are workforce protections, inclusive benefits, supporting an inclusive culture, corporate social responsibility, and responsible citizenship. A company can lose CEI points if it doesn't fulfill HRC's demand or integration of intersectionality in professional development, skills-based or other training, or if it doesn't use a supplier diversity program with demonstrated effort to include certified LGBTQ plus suppliers. James Lindsay, a political podcaster who runs a site called New Discourses, told The Post that the Human Rights Campaign administers the CEI ranking like an extortion racket, like the mafia. It doesn't just sit back passively either. HRC sends representatives to corporations every year telling them what kind of stuff they have to make visible at the company. They give them a list of demands as if they don't follow through. And if they don't follow through, there's a threat that you won't keep your CEI score. The CEI is a lesser known part of the burgeoning ESG, environmental, social, and corporate governance, ethical investing movement, increasingly pushed by the country's top three investment firms. ESG funds invest in companies that oppose fossil fuels, push for unionization, and stress racial and gender equity over merit in hiring and board selection. As a result, some American CEOs are more concerned about pleasing BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street Bank, who are among the top shareholders of most American publicly traded corporations, including Nike, Anheuser-Busch, and Kate Spade, that they are about irritating conservatives, numerous sources told The Post. This week, Mulvaney's new ad campaign with Bud Light and Nike ruffled the feathers of critics from country star Travis Tritt and Kid Rock, who tweeted a video of himself shooting cases of Bud Light to female Olympians and even Caitlyn Jenner, who said of Nike, "It is a shame to see such an iconic American company go so woke. This is an outrage." Mulvaney, 26, who transitioned from male to female in the beginning of March 2021, has reportedly earned more than $1 million from endorsements, including fashion and beauty brands that also include Ulta Beauty, Pulse Labs, and CeraVe, as well as Crest and Instacart and, I think it's Olay, whatever that skin stuff is, Olay. She's also gained 10 million followers on TikTok, but neither Kid Rock nor even Mulvaney are who America's top execs are trying to impress, experts say. The big fund managers like BlackRock all embrace this ESG orthodoxy in how they apply pressure to top corporate management teams and boards, and they determine, in many cases, executive compensation and bonuses and who gets reelected or reappointed to boards. Entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, who is running for president as a Republican and authored Woke Inc. Inside America's Social Justice Scam, told The Post they can make it very difficult for you if you don't abide by their agendas. Sounds like the mob. In 2018, BlackRock CEO Larry Flint, who oversees Larry Fink.
Well, one of the same.
Yeah, that was the porn. That was the Hustler, Penthouse magazine guy. This is Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, who oversees assets worth $8.6 trillion and has been called the face of ESG, wrote a now infamous letter to CEOs titled A Sense of Purpose that pushed a new model of governance in line with ESG values, very pro-China. Society is demanding that companies, both public and private, serve a social purpose. Fink wrote, to prosper over time, every company must not only deliver financial performance, but also show how it makes a positive contribution to society. Fink also let it be known that if a company doesn't engage with the community and have a sense of purpose, it will ultimately lose the license to operate from key stakeholders. In December, Florida pulled $2 billion worth of state assets managed by BlackRock. I think it's undemocratic of major asset managers to use their power to influence societal outcomes, Governor Ron DeSantis said at the time. Fink has denied that ESG is political, but key staff managing his ESG operations worked in the Obama administration and donate to Senator Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. In his first video, President Joe Biden last month rejected a GOP-backed bill that sought to block ESG investing, especially in pension funds, where critics say American retirement funds will be sacrificed to a radical left-wing agenda. Protesters in Paris targeted BlackRock's office there this week due to the company's role in managing and privatizing pensions, which are at the heart of the French government's recent retirement age reforms. ESG and CEI proponents say that adhering to socially conscious values when investing and managing a company will make the world a better place. Not everyone agrees. Derek Kreifels is the co-founder and CEO of State Financial Officers Foundation, one of several financial officers fighting ESG on a national level. We've also had Second Vote on here. He calls ESG itself a highly subjective political score infiltrating all walks of life, forcing progressive policies on everyday Americans and resulting in higher prices at the pump and at the store. The Corporate Equality Index is an ominous cog in ESG's wheel, Rifles told The Post. The problem with measures like CEI and its big brother ESG is that it introduces an incentive structure outside of the bounds of business, often in ways contradictory to fiduciary duty, Rifles said. Whether Anheuser-Busch was trying to cash in on Dylan Mulvaney's TikTok following or chasing higher CEI ratings for inclusivity, the backlash has been significant, and the stakeholders to whom the company is obligated, and the stockholders to whom the company is obligated will feel the pinch. Clip number three.
Sponsoring Dylan Mulvaney now for fucking sports bras, okay? I'm sorry, Dylan doesn't have breasts. Dylan's been taking some sort of a hormone that has turned Dylan into some, I don't know what's happening there, but those are not breasts. And Dylan doesn't need any sort of a bra, never mind a sports bra. You, the three ladies on this program right now have six boobs between us, and we actually know what it's like to wear a bra, and no one would be inspired to buy one based on non-breasted Dylan Mulvaney prancing around in a Nike sports bra. By the way, Dylan also appears to have an eating disorder. I'm just going to say it. But Dylan is about 40 pounds soaking wet. So this should not be anybody's spokesperson for anything.
Oh, showing this picture of Dylan. I can't look anymore, Steve. This is just...
Is that the end of the clip? Okay. Well, yeah. Thank you, Megyn Kelly. Such a firebrand. And it's okay with me. I've always hated Bud Light and all light beers, really. But I loved Budweiser. Always have, even though growing up, they told me they were draining the lake we always camped at, Berryessa in California. Maybe true. But I could drink a bunch of them and not get sick. Anyway, it's Yingling for me from now on. Good Pennsylvania beer that knows who its market is. Established in 1829, the oldest operating brewing company in the United States. I can't do Pabst and sick of Fat Tire. What's not okay? Budweiser factories nationwide were reportedly the targets of bomb threats this week as emotions run high over parent company Anheuser-Busch making a deal with its new Bud Light pitch woman and Dylan Mulvaney. The Los Angeles Police Department confirmed that officers responded to a call from an Anheuser-Busch facility in the Van Nuys section of the city on Thursday. Yeah, sure. A spokesperson for the St. Louis-based beer maker told Patch that several other facilities across the country received bomb threats. It is unclear how many facilities were targeted.
Steve, that was a press release put out by Anheuser-Busch. No one did anything.
You're so cynical. You must be listening to this show. People take their beers very seriously. $4 billion to $5 billion in value in Anheuser-Busch stock has been lost since March 31st. Oops. Stay tuned for my thoughts of the day.
Welcome to my quotes for the day. Lyrics, actually. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify and hit the subscribe button and follow us. While you're there, go ahead and leave a comment. As you heard, I will read it. And thanks for doing it. One fine day you wake up completely, hopelessly fallen in love. He's just what you're looking for. The only problem is that the man's not sure. Another guy will give you everything. The only problem is you don't feel a thing. Well, I know from experience, nothing's ever going to make perfect sense. Oh, one day you get what you want, but it's not what you think. Then you get what you need. That's the Way is a song written by Holly Lamar and recorded by American country music singer Joe D. Messina. It was released in May 2000 as lead-off single for her album Burn. The song spent 4 weeks at the top of the Hot Country Singles and Tracks, now Hot Country Songs, and was her highest peaking single on the Billboard Hot 100, where it reached number 25. Cause I can feel you breathe washing over me, and suddenly I'm melting into you. There's nothing left to prove. Baby, all we need is just to be caught up in the touch, slow and steady rush. Baby, isn't that the way that love's supposed to be? Breathe is a song written by Holly Lamar and recorded by American country music artist Faith Hill. Warner Brothers Records released it on October 4th, 1999, as the first single from Hill's fourth album of the same year, Breathe, became Hill's seventh number one on the top country songs chart in the United States, spending 6 weeks at number one. It also peaked at number two on the Billboard Hot 100 chart in April 2000. Despite not peaking at number one, it was the number one single of 2000. That's it for this episode. Really hope you like it. Thank you, Holly Lamar. I hope you find justice, if not revenge, in Tennessee. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the mcview.us. New issue out today. Peace in our time. Everybody wants an easy ride on the merry-go-round that we call life. Take a drive on cruise control, then you wait to find it's a winding road. I had my dreams in view when the money ran out and the engine blew. Hung my tears out to dry, then my dreams fell out of that clear blue sky. And I was walking the clouds, feeling so safe and sound. Something else knocks me down. Oh, that's the way it is. You gotta roll with the punches. In the air, laughter of the children and the pumpkins at the county fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.